down around 60 tonight, and it'll be mostly sunny with highs in the upper 70s again tomorrow night. Here's special coverage.
Good evening. This is live special coverage of the Republican National Convention from NPR News. I'm Susan Davis. It is the final night of the convention, and for the third time, Donald Trump will accept his party's nomination for president. Trump has said he has completely rewritten his speech after surviving an assassination attempt with a renewed focus to unite the nation. Trump will be introduced by his longtime friend, Dana White, the president and CEO of the Ultimate Fighting Championship. His wife, Melania, will make an appearance, but in a break with tradition, she is not expected to speak. However, his son, Eric, will address delegates. We're going to be bringing you live speeches and analysis all night on your public radio station and on video, which you can watch on many member station websites and at NPR.org. We're going to be bringing you into our studios tonight and taking you to the Fiserv Forum in Milwaukee, which is where we will begin tonight. My colleague NPR correspondent Danielle Kurtzleben is on the floor of that convention hall. Hey, Danielle.
Hey, Sue.
So, Danielle, you were at the campaign rally at which there was an assassination attempt against Donald Trump, and you went directly into Milwaukee, where you have spent the last four nights on the floor of the convention hall. Sum it all up for me. Where is your mind right now at this moment awaiting Donald Trump's speech tonight?
I'm really curious what tone he strikes when he takes the stage tonight. Thus far, this RNC has been a real departure from your typical Trump rally. They've really scrubbed it clean of a lot of the controversy that Trump spouts at his rallies, or controversial topics, I should say. For example, we have heard very little talk of abortion, whereas outside of this convention, Donald Trump will take credit for the overturning of Roe, or at least talk about how bad he thinks abortion is. That's one thing. At his rallies, he calls people jailed for their actions on January 6th. He calls them the January 6th hostages. We've heard none of that this week. We have heard very little about the supposedly stolen 2020 election. Of course, it was not stolen. Joe Biden won it. We've heard very little about that this week. This convention has been scrubbed clean of all of that. So I'm very curious how Trump talks tonight.
You've written a lot and reported a lot about how Donald Trump has changed the culture of the Republican Party. And I think nothing exemplifies that better, knowing that on this convention stage tonight, delegates are supposed to hear from both Hulk Hogan and the evangelical leader, Franklin Graham.
Yeah, there has been a set theme for each night of this convention. For example, foreign policy or safety. Tonight's theme is just Make America Great Again. And if I had to tell you what that means based on the list of speakers, the two themes that I can really pick out are fighting, as in Hulk Hogan, the CEO of the UFC, Linda McMahon, the former CEO of WWE, and also Jesus. We are going to have Franklin Graham, the preacher and son of Billy Graham. We had a preacher from Detroit earlier tonight. There's been a fair bit of talk about God tonight. This is the Trumpiest night that we have had tonight. Tucker Carlson, you don't bring Tucker Carlson up if you want to be warm, fuzzy, and promote a message of unity. Tucker Carlson was warmly received. Tonight, it really just seems like a night about Trump. And I will add, you can see it on the floor down here. People are wearing their glitziest Trump regalia. It's a lot of rhinestones, a lot of sequins, just the wildest Trump suits, dresses, everything that you've ever seen.
Danielle, thank you so much. We'll be back to you shortly, but I want to go up to the NPR booth where NPR's Mara Liasson and Franco Ordonez have been listening to the program this evening. And Franco, let's start with you. You've been covering this campaign. This is the first time Donald Trump will give extended public remarks since the assassination attempt this weekend. What has the campaign told you about how he's approaching a speech tonight?
The campaign says that, you know, as you pointed out, that he wrote the speech, that he's been working on it, and that it's going to be very personal. I mean, I'm like Danielle. I am very curious what Trump we're going to get. Are we going to get the, you know, the grandpa Trump that we've been hearing about all week? Or are we going to get the fight, fight, fight Trump that this crowd is really longing for? And as we have heard time and time again. I mean, this is really Trump's moment to shine. As you say, it's his first speech since the shooting. Will he reflect on what he feels? As, you know, kind of sources have told me that he felt like he was touched by an angel. Is that going to come out today? Or is it going to be the strength versus weakness message that the campaign talks about all the time? And look, Dana White, the head of the UFC, is going to be introducing him. You got Kid Rock playing. You got Hulk Hogan. It doesn't speak to me that it's going to be Grandpa Trump, but I guess we'll find out.
Franco, it does feel like whenever we talk about Trump taking a new tone, we need to have this with a huge grain of salt here. This is something that has been said time and time before, and Trump often reverts to form. And also we should note, even if his tone changes tonight, his policies are still very much the same.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think when I talk to the campaign, that is something that they repeat over and over again, that even if this is a unity message, it will be framed in a America First agenda. It will be unifying the Republican Party. It will be bringing the tent or growing the tent larger. We saw Nikki Haley, the governor of South Carolina, and his former rival here. We saw Ron DeSantis, the Florida governor, here. I think that's kind of the message that keeps repeating among Republicans here. I was talking to one of his surrogates early today. He said, yes, he expects unity message, but at the same time, he also expects a contrast. And that contrast is something they have been hammering over and over again between Trump and Biden. We talked about strength versus weakness. It's also about success versus failure. They see Trump as the successful president from 4 years ago. They argue Biden is the unsuccessful president right now.
Mara Lyson, I know you have a lot on your mind, so this is when I just say, Mara, what are your thoughts right now?
Look, I'll make a really wild guess. I bet you're going to hear some national unity phrases that we're primed to watch for, because that's how they're selling this speech. But I think we're going to have plenty of standard Trump, us versus them. You know, I was the best president in history, and Biden was the worst, and it'll go on from there. He usually has something for everyone, and I wouldn't be surprised if this speech has it too. Look, I think one thing about unity, this has been a unified convention.
Sure.
The Republican Party is more unified than ever. There are no dissenters here, not a single one. And the prior dissenters have come here and bent the knee and changed their tune and embraced Trump. So that's for sure. What Donald Trump sees as national unity, other than that the nation should unite behind him, is still unclear, and maybe we'll get some answers to that tonight.
All right, Mara and Franco, we'll be back to you in a bit, but I want to go back to the convention floor where we have veteran Republican pollster and strategist Frank Luntz attending what I can only imagine is one of many conventions he's been to. And Frank, I want to start with this. Overwhelmingly this week, we've heard from the stage and from delegates a supreme sense of confidence that Donald Trump is going to win this election and maybe win it in a landslide. So I'm asking you to put your pollster hat on here and say, are Republicans being correctly confident or overly confident?
I think they're a bit overly confident, but make no mistake, I've not seen the Democratic nominee as weak, an incumbent nominee as weak as Joe Biden at this point in the campaign. And Donald Trump, who's noticeably run behind in 2016 and 2020, I'm looking around this convention hall right now, and I'm seeing people on stage that don't look like typical traditional Republicans. This has really been a remarkable convention featuring union members, African Americans, Latinos, people who you don't think of as being Republican are actively being shown. And the messaging, as a wordsmith, the messaging has been quite strong, quite optimistic. Yes, to your previous guess, there are the occasional attacks, the shots at the administration, but there's as much hopeful, optimistic language and a focus on exactly what they want to change. If I were advising this convention, which I do not, in fact, let me let you in on a secret. This is the first Republican convention since 1992 that I've not written a single word by a single speaker.
Wow.
If I were writing these words, a lot of them, I would have written for this convention.
As we talk at this hour, it is quite possible that President Biden might decide to ultimately get out of this presidential race. And I'm curious, if that were to happen, does that scramble everything? Does that reset this campaign?
Yes, it does. And in fact, I'm saying to some of the Republicans here, be careful what you wish for. This is like the dog that catches the car. It's not good for the car, and it's really not good for the dog. People know Trump. They know Biden. They know the two administrations. They have a more favorable reaction to Donald Trump in every single poll on the key issues that matter. With Kamala Harris, it's everything is up for grabs. And there are other Democrats that are much stronger than her. Some of the governors, a couple of the senators, they should be very careful because they're trying to push Biden over the edge, but they don't know what comes up next, and that's actually more important.
It's one of the things that my colleague Mara Liasson, who you were just hearing from, says a lot, is that Donald Trump won in 2016 with 46%, and he lost in 2020 with a little over 46%. And it does seem that Donald Trump's appeal, the MAGA coalition, hasn't really proven that it can rise above that 47, maybe, percent ceiling.
Well, all I have to say is that when she says something, I listen to her.
Me too.
But all I would suggest is, in the key swing states, Nevada, Arizona, big Latino votes, Trump is doing better than any Republican in recent times among Latino voters. The young black male vote under age 40, Trump is doing historically good among them, and that could be enough to bring home Georgia and North Carolina. And the ones that I'm watching the most, because they will decide this election, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, Trump is winning a shockingly high percentage of union voters. In fact, in our polling, take out the teachers' union and the government unions, and Trump is actually even with Joe Biden among working-class union voters. We've never seen that before. This is a new coalition. It's not one that I remember from when I joined the Republican Party, but the choice of J.D. Vance and his articulation of what it is to be a hardworking taxpayer struggling paycheck to paycheck, this is a message that works, and it's working.
What do you think? Is that what you think J.D. Vance brings to this ticket, that he's able to juice that sort of working class voter that has really been drawn into the MAGA movement?
Yes, and it's because he's authentically working class. This is who he is. Donald Trump was born wealthy. I mean, we forget that Trump's appeal to working class voters is ironic, yeah, considering that Trump was, that's not his background. J.D. Vance, that's who he is. That's where he's from. That's he communicates that so well. You saw that in the last night's speech. Initially, I thought it might have been better for Trump to try to expand the coalition by picking a woman or an African-American. After listening to the speech last night, I think it's actually quite smart of him, because in the end, there are more working class voters who truly live paycheck to paycheck than any other single issue or single attribute voter. And that's why it seems to be a very smart pick so far. We're going to have to see what happens in the debates.
Frank, I'm curious to get your perspective on this, because as you noted, you've been involved in conventions a long time, Republican politics your whole life. It certainly seems like the messages from this convention, a more populist Republican Party, a more isolationist Republican Party. Do you see this as sort of a turning point, finally, for the Republican Party as fully the party of Donald Trump?
It's more than a turning point. That's a great question. The truth is, the party has already turned. This is not the party of Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush. This is not even the party of George W. Bush or John McCain. This is a new agenda with different voters. And let's talk about the negatives, the people that Trump is going to lose. Suburban women, upper middle class, concerned about abortion and some of the issues that we haven't talked about. Trump is going to have problem in the suburban areas that were once solidly Republican. However, he gains more votes from people who live paycheck to paycheck, which is one quarter of America, than he loses in the suburbs. So overall, it's a net gain. And remember, in virtually every survey, Trump is either tied or leading Joe Biden, and particularly the key swing states. This never happened in 2016, never happened in 2020.
Yeah.
It's a new party with new polling, and I think that this coalition may be strong enough to hold through November.
Do you think more states are being put on the map? We're seeing polling in places like Minnesota and Virginia that suggests that maybe they're more in play than we've been paying attention.
You just picked the two states that I'm watching very carefully. Minnesota always looks close, but never comes the way of the Republicans. The same thing with Virginia, which used to be a Republican state. I would also add New Hampshire to that. So we got three states with enough electoral votes to give Trump the victory should he lose Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. I've heard the idea that you take the Pennsylvania governor and that brings over a significant amount of votes to the Democratic ticket. But if he takes the states that I mentioned and just one of Virginia, Minnesota, or New Hampshire, and he wins the election, it's going to be a wild ride over the next 110 days. And we don't even know what's going to happen on the Democratic side yet.
Republican pollster and veteran strategist Frank Luntz, thanks for talking. I always appreciate your insights.
This is an honor. Thank you for having me.
And joining me in studio tonight and all week long, my friend, senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. I think wild ride for the next 110 days seems like a fitting description of this race where it stands.
Perhaps an understatement. Let's face it, yeah. it's been off the chain for several weeks now,
yeah.
Where you literally have to be watching the news constantly because things happen. Much of the country was watching that rally in Butler, Pennsylvania on Saturday afternoon with no idea, of course, that it was going to be a historic event. They just thought it was another Trump rally, looked a lot like it. The crowd looked a lot like a typical Trump crowd. He got started in very typical Trump fashion. It seemed like business as usual. And then, of course, the shots rang out. So now we're living in a different world.
Yeah.
So we just have no way of predicting, first of all, what's going to happen on the Democratic side, although we've seen the pendulum swing back and forth between, oh, Biden will never get out, to, well, Biden's going to have to get out.
It's back, volatile, to say the least.
Back to, again, no, he'll never get out, and then he'll have to get out. So that can't go on much longer. They've already delayed what was going to be an early virtual vote by which the delegates would affirm that he was the nominee. He has 90% of the delegates already committed to him. So they're his delegates. It's a question of when they actually vote. And if they were to move it up into the first days of August, well, that would seem to foreclose any possibility of there being anyone else on the ticket or anyone else in the top slot. So let's just say there's much still to happen. And then we have to determine how the person, if there is another person, stacks up against Donald Trump. How well does Joe Biden run if he's still the nominee? And there will be changes in circumstances. I think that you have to take the volatility of the year up to now as an indicator of what we will see for the rest of the campaign.
And just to recap for a minute, we are currently on the convention floor just having a musical interlude, so you get to listen to Ron and I. Although I will say the house band at this convention has been pretty good. A lot of good covers of great Americana rock hits. That's a fair statement, I think, to say, Ron.
Absolutely. By convention standards, I'd had enough brass bands.
And we are awaiting main stage remarks from Franklin Graham, evangelical leader and son of the late Billy Graham. I am in studio with senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving, and you're listening to special coverage of the Republican National Convention from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR's elections coverage comes from Sattva, committed to making handcrafted mattresses that help lull people to sleep and keep them sleeping soundly. More information is at sattva.com/NPR.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from North American Cultural Laboratory, Highland Lake, New York. An experimental workspace for performing artists and inquisitive audiences, creating a space for community celebration throughout the year. NACL.org.
It's Radio Catskill. Thank you for being here with us. This special coverage of the Republican National Convention. Remember, it's still our summer fun drive. We need to meet our goal, and we need help from listeners like you. Call 845-482-4141 or go to wjffradio.org. It's WJFFradio.org to make your donation now. Clear tonight, overnight low down to 54, mostly sunny tomorrow with a high of 77, and clear again tomorrow night with overnight low in the mid-50s once again. So mild weather, clear, and low humidity as well. This is Radio Catskill.
You're listening to live special coverage of the Republican National Convention from NPR News, and we're joined now by NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith, who is also with us at the Fiserv Forum, but has had a very busy day talking mostly to Democrats. Tam, it seems quite possible in this hour that President Biden could consider dropping out of the race in the coming days. He is currently at his Rehoboth, Delaware house after testing positive for COVID. Before we get to the politics, what do we know about the president's condition?
His doctor put out a note today saying that the president is still doing well. He's still taking that antiviral drug Paxlovid. And he has that runny nose and cough, but his vital signs are normal and he doesn't have a fever. However, the vital signs on his campaign are a different matter altogether.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly been the continuing drumbeat of notable Democrats publicly calling for Biden to get out of the race, adding to the list today, Montana Senator John Tester.
Yeah, and Montana Senator John Tester is what you would call a frontline Democrat. He is highly endangered in a state that former President Trump won handily. And he is separating himself from President Biden, saying that Biden should drop out of the race. But he's not the only one. You also have Democratic leaders, top Democrats, who are putting out statements that are not at all endorsing the president. And they're not saying he's the party's nominee. They are saying things like he should consider his path forward, or they are very concerned about his legacy. Someone who is close to former President Obama said today that he is someone who is let me actually read you the actual quote there. He said that President Obama is protective of President Biden, both personally and his administration's accomplishments. Protective is not a word that says go, run, Joe, run.
Yeah. I mean, you can read between the lines here and see former President Obama, former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, all sort of playing a chess game in which they're clearly indicating that they would be okay with Joe Biden getting out of the race. So I'm curious, what is the White House telling you when you're pressing them on this very question?
Biden campaign insists that he is in the race. And why do you guys keep asking the same question? He's in the race. He's not going anywhere. That's what they say. That is the official word. But I did talk to a senior Biden advisor today who said that they feel like they just can't get a break, that there have been moments when it felt like maybe he was building some momentum, especially when he has had these rallies in blue wall states, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. At those rallies, people have been telling him, looking him in the eyes, and saying, Joe, don't get out. Do it. Just keep going. But then you get back to Washington, and everyone is telling him that he has to go, that he's going to drag Democrats down with them. And this person I talked to said, at this point, it's just not clear that President Biden can ever really recover from this, that people now see him in a different light after that debate, that his flaws, his gaffes, his regular gaffes that are always a Bidenism, now those are seen in a different light and people are looking for them. And this person just wasn't sure that Biden could recover from it. In terms of what comes next, though, this person says it could be Hunger Games, and they aren't sure what sort of campaign would rise from the ashes.
Tam, I would note, I was just speaking with Frank Luntz and asked him the question, what does it do to the race if Joe Biden gets out? And he said, Republicans shouldn't be too confident in that moment, that it could scramble the calculations that everyone's making about Donald Trump on the ballot this November.
Well, one thing it would certainly do is divert attention away from former President Trump. He is someone who often captivates audiences, as we'll see here tonight. But if there is a Hunger Games situation in the Democratic Party, people are going to be watching that closely. One top Democrat I talked to, who's part of the Democratic National Committee, said that this is going to be the story of your lives if it happens, and that the convention and the lead up to the convention will be something that hasn't been seen in this country since 1968 or even before that.
All right, Tam, I'm going to let you go. We're going to go to the convention floor, where Donald Trump is walking through and approaching the convention floor. I believe he is still wearing, yes, he is still wearing the bandage over his ear, and he is dressed in his trademark blue suit and red tie. It does look like he is being flanked by members of the Trump family. His oldest son, Donald Trump Jr., who spoke last night, is right behind him. It looks like a group of his grandchildren is also with him. I have to admit, I do not know all of the grandchildren's names, but we do know one of his oldest grandchildren, Kai Trump, addressed the convention last night where she talked about her grandpa. He's entering the family seating area where he's been watching a lot of the speeches play out all week long. We are certainly looking for a glimpse of his wife, Melania Trump. She is, as I said earlier, not expected to speak at the convention, but she is expected to appear on stage. And he is joined with, yes, it looks like a number of his grandchildren, and the crowd, obviously, all week long, completely living for the moment when Trump comes in. He just mouthed thank you, everybody, to the crowd, clapping, standing, clearly getting a standing ovation on the Make America Great Once Again sign right over his right shoulder, and the family is taking their seats and lining up. We are awaiting the remarks of Franklin Graham. And while we await those remarks, I'm going to head to my colleague, NPR's David Folkenflik, who joins me now. David, we wanted to bring you in because earlier this evening, there was a speech from the main stage from former Fox News anchor Tucker Carlson. Here's some of that.
And I have to say, you know, I think it changed him. He reached out to Trump within hours of it that night. And what he said to me that night, having just been shot in the face, he said not a single word about himself. He said only how amazed he was and how proud he was of the crowd, which didn't run. And I thought two things. The first thing I thought was, well, of course they didn't run. His courage gave them heart. A leader's courage gives courage to his people. And the second thing I thought was, this is the selfish guy I've been hearing about for 9 years, really? Not a word about himself? About his people, period. And the second thing I noticed, which I don't think anyone has remarked upon in public, but I'm just going to since I don't have a script, like, why not? Is that he turned down the most obvious opportunity in politics to inflame the nation after being shot. To inflame the nation. Which is an opportunity that almost every other politician I've ever met, and certainly his opponents, would have taken instantly.
Hey, David, thank you for being here. Before we get into our questions, since I have you here, I want to go back to the convention stage where Hulk Hogan has just started to give remarks.
There was so much energy in this room, I felt maybe I was in Madison Square Garden getting ready to win another world title. Or maybe I thought the vibe was so intense, the energy was so crazy, it felt like maybe I was going to press that no-good, stinky giant over my head and slam him through the mat, brother. But what I found out was I was in a room full of real Americans, brother. And at the end of the day, with our leader up there, my hero, that gladiator, we're going to bring America back together. One real American at a time, brother.
That was Hulk Hogan speaking from the convention floor, and I'm joined now by my colleague, David Folkenflik. David, I'm sorry to cut you off early, but when you have a chance to throw to Hulk Hogan for a minute, you got to take it, you know?
You don't just throw to Hulk Hogan, you body slam to Hulk Hogan.
You are here, though, of course, to talk about Tucker Carlson, who spoke earlier this evening. Obviously, this is a story you've covered a long time. He was fired from Fox News more than a year ago. Tonight, he was welcomed at the RNC with open arms. He's been sitting with Donald Trump in the family and friends box. Tucker Carlson, he's back.
Yeah, he's back, and he's able to sort of claim this resurrection in part because of the way in which Trump has responded to him, not only inviting him into his booth, as you spoke about, not only giving him this position of prominence on the final night, the night where Trump himself finally addresses the party faithful, right? But he also is going to take credit in a victory lap for the naming of J.D. Vance, the Ohio senator, whom has embraced a kind of populist nationalism that is very similar to what Tucker Carlson has embraced himself on the air. And more recently, since his exile from Fox News, his ouster there and amidst scandal and litigation. Online as well, on his own platforms digitally. So he's going to take credit at a time when there are a lot of folks, including his former boss, Rupert Murdoch, the founder of Fox News, the controlling owner of The Wall Street Journal and The New York Post. A number of folks in the Republican establishment didn't want J.D. Vance for just that reason, because he has at least rhetorically embraced positions that would seem to promote certain kinds of regulations that working class families might be in favor of and big companies might not.
I had a Republican member of Congress tell me a few months ago that he believed that Tucker Carlson was the second most influential person in the Republican Party besides Donald Trump. I'm curious what your take is on what Tucker Carlson means to the Republican Party right now.
You know, that's certainly what Tucker Carlson would have you believe. And there are times he has performed that role. You know, tonight he was attesting to Trump's humor, courage and empathy, you know, sort of validating Trump in a way that I think a lot of Trump's fans and voters find appealing and humorous, but also, you know, offer somebody who's very smooth, who, as Trump puts a lot of stock in, looks the part. He also, let's be clear here, you know, he talks about Trump as a unifier, not only as having been courageous after being shot at the rally in Butler, Pennsylvania, but as in inspiring people and in unifying people, and that he's been changed by this shooting and that this party is unified behind him. But let's be clear about the party that is unified. It's a party in which critics, including Vance, including Senator Marco Rubio, including Governor Ron DeSantis, have been brought to heel, or in the case of people like former Congresswoman Liz Cheney, have been cast out. And that's the way in which this party has been unified. And let's be clear, Tucker Carlson has been part of that process. He was an enforcer at that 8 o'clock perch, the most powerful single person in some ways on cable news as a political influencer on Fox. And now trying to arise in that same role online, and by elevating his influence with Don Jr., and he's sort of having this bromance with Donald Trump visibly embracing him in this way, you know, Tucker at least gets to give off the aura of having that kind of influence once again.
David, thank you so much. We're going to head back to the floor where we're going to pick back up with Hulk Hogan addressing the RNC.
And I'm proud to support my hero as the next president of this United States. You know, guys, I've known Donald Trump for over 35 years. You know, hold on a second. Hold on. I just had a flashback, man. This is really tripping. You know, the last time I was up on stage, Donald Trump was sitting at ringside at the Trump Plaza. I was bleeding like a pig, and I won the world title right in front of Donald J. Trump. And you know something? He's gonna win in November, and we're all gonna be champions again when he wins. And like I said, I've known that man for over 35 years. And he's always been the biggest patriot, and he still is. He's always told you exactly what he thought, and he still does, brother. And no matter the odds, he always finds a way to win. And when he's back in our White House, America is going to start winning again. You know, guys, over my career, I've been in the ring with some of the biggest, some of the baddest dudes on the planet. And I've squared off against warriors. Ooh, yeah, savages. And I've even, like I said, body slammed giants in the middle of the ring. And I know tough guys. But let me tell you something, brother. Donald Trump is the toughest of them all. They've thrown everything at Donald Trump. All the investigations, the impeachments, the court cases, and he's still standing and kicking their butts. You know, we never had it better than the Trump years. Back then, we had a thriving economy. We had strong borders. We had safe streets. We had peace and respect around the world. But then we lost it all in a blink of an eye. Crime is out of control. The border is out of control. The price of food and gas and housing is out of control. And the only person who can clean this up is Donald Trump. You know, guys, I really, really love this country. And I've lived the American dream. And I want my kids, your kids, and all those little teeny Hulkamaniacs out there to live the American dream too. This November, guys, we can save the American dream for everyone. And Donald Trump is the president who will get the job done. So all you criminals, all you lowlifes, all you scumbags, all you drug dealers, and all you crooked politicians need to answer one question, brother. What you gonna do when Donald Trump and all the Trumpomaniacs run wild on you, brother? God bless you, and thank you.
That was former wrestler Hulk Hogan doing what Hulk Hogan does at the convention at the RNC. Donald Trump is in the arena, and he's currently raising his fist at Hulk Hogan, very pleased with that speech. And we go to the convention floor where NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben got to see it all. Danielle, I just have to ask you, what was that moment like?
The moment where he tore off the sleeveless shirt to reveal the Trump fan shirt underneath was, I do believe, the loudest moment of the convention so far. I feel pretty safe saying that. And I mean, I was just thinking as he was talking, a guy who's hyper-masculine, loves spectacle, and mostly appeals to older Americans. I don't know if you can find a better avatar for the Donald Trump campaign than Hulk Hogan, really.
You know, at the points throughout this convention, when people have been speaking, they cut to Trump. And I have to be frank, a lot of times he, you know, was kind of straight-faced or just nodding along. And he really seemed to be personally enjoying right. The Hulk Hogan speech in a way that he has not enjoyed as much some of the other speakers in this convention.
Right. That doesn't surprise me. I mean, he's been, yeah, you're right, like warmly receiving, politely receiving many of the people who have come to pay homage to him tonight. But this, yeah, I couldn't see him personally, I should say, but it is not surprising that that kind of a performance really pleased him.
This transition on the floor that's playing out, we should note, and we'll go to him shortly. Franklin Graham is speaking on the floor. But Danielle, it's a hard turn to go from Hulk Hogan to Franklin Graham.
It really is. Now, Franklin Graham is the son of Billy Graham. For those who don't know, Billy Graham was the evangelist who was a spiritual counselor to presidents of both parties. Now, Franklin Graham is not exactly that. He is a preacher, but I've seen him referred to in the past as a prodigal son. He came late to the Christian faith. He was considered a sort of bad boy son of Billy Graham's. But he is not bipartisan, it is fair to say. He, for example, has courted a lot of controversy by saying things that controversial sells it short. Some of it is downright hateful. He, for example, said that at one point that Barack Obama, when he was president, was born a Muslim. That, of course, is not true. During the 2020 Democratic primary nomination, he tweeted things about homosexuality, negative things about homosexuality, when Pete Buttigieg, now the transportation secretary, was running for the Democratic nomination, upset a lot of voters then as well. So this is not a warm, fuzzy Christian. This is a very different breed of Christian.
All right, let's go to the convention floor and hear some of his remarks.
In 2016, he said he would defend religious liberty. And guess what? He did. In 2019, I was with him at the United Nations when the first president of history of this country stood there to advocate for religious liberty worldwide. When American citizen and Pastor Andrew Brunson was being held in a Turkish jail on false accusations, President Trump demanded that he be released. And he applied economic pressure and sanctions until they did that. I'm grateful and thankful for what he did as a 45th president of the United States. And I know that as the 47th president, he will keep his word to the American people to make America great once again.
That was Evangelical leader Franklin Graham addressing the Republican National Convention. And we're going to go up to the NPR booth where we have a guest. Sarah Parshall Perry is a senior legal fellow at the Heritage Foundation, and she joins me now. Sarah, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You are at the Heritage Foundation, which has long been central to articulating the conservative movement's agenda. This time around, it's known as Project 2025. Obviously, your political opponents have been using this document to run against Republicans in the campaign. So I would give you an opportunity here to say, how would you explain Project 2025 to people?
Project 2025 is exactly the same thing that we've done since 1980, every presidential election, and provided to every candidate, regardless of politics or political affiliation. In fact, not only were no presidential candidates involved in the crafting of Project 2025, the sole difference this year was that we built a coalition of more than 100 conservative organizations, in addition to publishing everything online. So there would be nothing in the shadows, nothing done that wasn't immediately examinable by anyone who found the project at project2025.org. I encourage your viewers and listeners to visit that and do a word search, do a category search. It is a long document, but that's because it utilizes more than 400 experts in areas from economic policy to national defense to education, and really presents what we believe as a coalition of conservatives is the best vision for a free, prosperous, safe, and flourishing America.
I read a quote from you at Milwaukee where you were speaking at an event where you said, the primary responsibility, I think, of the next administration is to make sure that they don't sacrifice children on the altar of woke progressivism. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, I think we are now seeing in public education more of an effort to indoctrinate than we are to educate. Our math and reading literacy scores are at 30%. We actually find ourselves in the middle of the pack of most developed nations in the world in terms of our ability to produce young, educated minds for math and literacy specifically. We have more work to do when it counts to getting back to basics in the entire elimination of DEI and inclusion and what we're seeing now, which is a trend of illustrated porn in school libraries. And the Supreme Court's very clear about where First Amendment protections are, but it is also very clear about the lacking maturity and the lack of emotional capacity of children. And that there are some things that they should not be subject to and that schools can restrict from being involved with. And so our perspective there is that education should focus on education. It shouldn't focus on ideals that are those of one political party over another or pet projects of the teachers' unions. And we know that both the AFT and the NEA have been very involved in American education in the last 4 years.
What would you like to see the first priorities of a Trump administration be, knowing that we don't know what the control of Congress or it might be, but what he could do as president? What do you think he needs to focus on first?
Well, I think the first thing he needs to do is ensure the fact that there is much rulemaking to be done and revoke the informal guidance that we've seen interpreting many provisions of federal law, whether they are in the anti-discrimination field in medical services or the anti-discrimination field in educational services. He's taken liberties with a certain amount of legal interpretation. He's lost multiple times as far as the Title IX rewrite is concerned, and Title IX, the Education Amendments of 1972, obviously a hallmark of the women's liberation movement, guaranteed sex equality in education for 52 years. Now, obviously, subject to a brand new rule that will be enforced as of August 1st, expanding the definition of sex to include gender identity or gender expression, something not only not supported by Supreme Court law, but something actually that flies in the face of what the entire purpose and mission was of Title IX in the first place. So he's got a lot of work to do. I think the first is to begin the rulemaking process, revoke the informal guidance that informed many of those expansive policies in the administrative state. And we've recently seen from the Supreme Court that they have no tolerance for an expansion of what we've called the fourth branch of government, and that is the administrative state. There are three branches, and they ought to be separated, and it is not for the executive to make law.
All right, Sarah Parshall Perry from the Heritage Foundation, thank you so much for your time. We're going to go back to the convention floor where Donald Trump's son Eric is speaking to delegates.
Unlike his predecessor, it was not a decision born out of necessity. Unlike the current president, it was not a decision that would enrich his family. Rather, it was a decision made out of love for this country and a deep concern for America's future. My father was clear it would not be easy, that there would be a huge price to pay, and that the attacks would be vicious. Looking back, that was an understatement. The made-up Russia hoax, the sham impeachments, the efforts to destroy an unbelievable company, a company that I run today, the efforts to cancel us, to silence him, to gag his free speech, and to drag him through every radical left courthouse in America, to take his life. Yet through it all, he's shown unwavering courage and determination, not just in public, but in every private conversation with me and our family. He stood tall, fueled not by personal ambition, but by a profound love for this country and a love for all of you, the American people. That man is my father. That man is the 45th president and soon to be 47th president of the United States. That man is Donald J. Trump. Each time I've stood on this stage, America has been at a dire crossroads. In 2016, many people began to doubt the promise of America. Our economy was struggling. Jobs were scarce. Our standing on the world stage was weak at best. Veterans were forgotten. Our military was in shambles. Our educational system was broken, ranked 30th in the world. He could no longer tolerate an inept administration. They handed $150 billion to Iran, a country that chants death to America, or witness the continued attacks on our Constitution and our religious liberty, or see the disrespect shown to our unbelievable law enforcement officers who are being disarmed, defunded, and persecuted each and every day. He could no longer stand to see words like Christmas stripped from public use, or the Pledge of Allegiance removed from our schools. But my father saw potential where others saw despair. Donald Trump built the New York City skyline. He did so during a time when businesses were turning away from the city he loved. Crime was rampant. The streets were dirty. But he had the Midas touch, and he turned those streets and neighborhoods into gold. He faced every challenge with tremendous vision and grit. As he did during the 2016 election, he rolled up his sleeves. He remained unapologetic. He did not care to be politically correct. He restored hope. He restored a voice to millions of Americans who had been ignored. He restored the American dream. Under my father's leadership, the economy climbed to record heights. Jobs were created at an unthinkable pace. Unemployment reached historic lows across all demographics. Wage growth soared. He cut taxes for hardworking families and businesses. He slashed regulations. We saw the greatest 401k increase in American history. People bought their first homes in an environment that saw 2 to 3% interest rates. They started their families. My father made the United States energy independent with the lowest gas prices in decades. My father made the United States safe. Our borders were closed. There was peace in the Middle East. Soleimani, al-Baghdadi, the terrorists were dead. My father made the United States respected again, with the courage to walk into countries like North Korea, with the courage to impose tariffs on China, and with the courage to tear up trade deals that cost Americans their jobs. He brought manufacturing back to America. Small businesses flourished. He did what he promised. He put America first. We were winning. Donald Trump made America great again. But he also created a movement. A movement that threatened the special interests and the political elites. A movement that cast a bright light on the institutions weaponized against the American people. You see it in our schools. God bless the moms who fought back. You see it in your workplace. You see it on every news station, in every newspaper. You see it in the military. The most iconic military installations on planet Earth are stripped of their identity and renamed. Fort Bragg, Benning, Fort Hood. You see it in Hollywood. You see it in our two-tier judicial system. They don't even hide it anymore. My father has been censored. The former president ripped off Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook while terrorist organizations remain intact. My father has been persecuted, targeted by far-left Democrats funded by special interest groups and hand-picked judges. My father has been pulled off the ballots of states, radical justices attempting to defy the will of millions of Americans who adore who he is and what he stands for. My father even became the target of an assassin who almost killed America's single greatest hope for our future. The swamp is terrified of this incredible movement. They're terrified of it. They're terrified of you and the tens of millions of people watching us on TV right now. They've tried everything to keep him from you, everything, to destroy his legacy, to destroy his family. They have failed and they will not win. I love my Florida delegation right here. Thank you. My father stands before you with the most votes of any Republican candidate in the history of our nation. He has defied the predictions of every political pundit. He fills stadiums across our country. He energizes Americans to the issues facing this nation and does so with unvarnished honesty. He is not a threat to democracy. He is a threat to those who despise our republic, many whom are bought and sold, bribed and coerced, people who have never signed the front of a check and who have been dependent on the government their entire adult lives. Today, as it was in 2016, America's at that crossroads again. Energy prices are soaring. Interest rates are crippling. Everything is unaffordable. The U.S. dollar has been diminished. Inflation has made it impossible for Americans to live, to save for their future. Our infrastructure is crumbling. Our border is out of control. Millions are dead and displaced in Russia and Ukraine, a war that has no end and a war that we are funding. The Middle East has become a hornet's nest. Our greatest ally, Israel, totally under siege. Fentanyl is killing our youth and destroying families, while the current administration stands idly by, hoping their inaction will import illegal votes. Crime terrorizes our cities and our suburbs as far-left policies handcuff police. Male athletes, guys my height, 6'5", are swimming in women's sports. Destroying the dreams of young girls who have trained every minute of their lives. We no longer trust our elections. We no longer trust our judicial system. And we no longer believe that our government is working in our best interest. In spite of where we are today as a nation, I'd like to speak to every American. To the homeless veteran sleeping under a bridge as illegal immigrants are housed in the most expensive hotels in New York. I'm sorry. We know it's wrong, and we will fix it. To the single mother who can no longer afford her rent, afford groceries, and has been forced to work 3 jobs, I'm sorry. It does not have to be this way. To the parents who lost a son or daughter to fentanyl, including the incredible woman that spoke the other night, while an administration does absolutely nothing, I'm sorry. Your government can do so much better, and it will. To the children who are being brainwashed instead of learning the fundamentals in school, I'm sorry. There are teachers who care, and my father will empower them. To the law enforcement officers, our brave border patrol, Secret Service agents who work every single day to protect our communities, knowing damn well that the system will throw you under the bus, I'm sorry. We will stand behind you. To commuters, often petrified to take a bus, take a train, or walk the streets in cities across our nation, I'm sorry. That man right there will fix this. To the construction workers, to the middle-class families, to the families with children with disabilities, families who can no longer afford medical benefits or to take a vacation, I'm sorry. We will make America great again. And to my father, who has been ruthlessly silenced, slandered, and attacked by a corrupt administration, I'm sorry. We know, and America knows, that they're not just after you, they're after all of us, and you just happen to be standing in their way. To all Americans watching tonight, the greatest retribution will be our success. Success not just for ourselves, but for our grandchildren and our children. Under President Donald J. Trump, the swamp will be drained. America will be respected. Our cities will be safe. Our streets will be clean. And our border will once again be secure. We will have peace. We will have prosperity. Your hard-earned tax dollars will enrich a better America, not be squandered in corrupt foreign nations. Education will be handed back to the states. We will no longer be 30th in the world. We will be first.